Welcome to the Success Mastery Academy with Brian Tracy, one of America's leading authorities on the development of human potential and personal effectiveness. Brian is an entertaining and dynamic speaker with a wonderful ability to inform and inspire audiences towards peak performance and high levels of achievement. Now, let's join Brian Tracy live from the Success Mastery Academy.
Thank you very much. Please sit down. Thank you. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate this, and I really appreciate that fine introduction. It reminds me of a gentleman who was introduced to the San Jose Chamber of Commerce as being one of the smartest business people in the country. He'd moved out to California some years before and made $1 million in the oil business. And he got up and he said, well, thank you very much for that introduction. However, it wasn't quite accurate because it wasn't really California. It was actually Pennsylvania. And it wasn't really the oil business. It was the coal business. And it wasn't really $1 million. It was only $100,000. And it wasn't me. It was my brother, and he didn't make it. He lost it. I appreciate the introduction, but here's a good question for you. Who's the most important person in this room? Yes, absolutely. Who's the second most important? The person next to you. We are at your service. You are the most important people here, and I thank you very much for coming. I can promise you the next 2 days are going to be remarkable. I have spent years and years and years, virtually my whole life, preparing what is in this course. And this is a state-of-the-art, brand-new course. It has never been offered in its entirety the way we're going to be going through it in the next 2 days. My promise to you is that if you will stay along with me, you will be different after 2 days and your life will be forever different. I have worked with more than 1 million people now who've come back and told me that a course like this has been the turning point for them. And so my goal is that it be the turning point for you. Albert Einstein was teaching at Oxford in 1942, and he had just administered an exam to a senior class of physics students. And he was on his way back to his office, and his teaching assistant was carrying the exams. Little English fellow, and he said, Dr. Einstein, he said, as they walked across the campus, he said, Dr. Einstein, that exam that you gave to the senior class, wasn't that the same exam you gave to the senior class last year? He said, yeah, it was the same exam. He said, well, Dr. Einstein, how could you give the same exam to the same class 2 years in a row? He says, well, he says, the answers have changed. That is immediately applicable to us, too, because our answers have changed, and our answers are changing, and our answers are changing at a rate that has never before been seen in all of human history. Our answers have changed. If I asked you what you were worrying about a year ago, the answers have changed. What was your major problem a year ago? What was your major health problem, your major personal problem, your major financial problem? What was your major worry? What were you preoccupied with when you were driving to and from work? If I asked you what your relationship problem was, or your customer problem, or your product problem, or your service problem, or your business problem, the answers have changed. And the answers are changing more rapidly than we've ever seen before. So in order for us to be successful, we have to change as well. In our society, we have what are called emulators, early adapters, late adapters, and sometimes never adapters. For instance, there are people who are not computer literate today, which is a remarkable thing. It's the same as not being able to use a touch-tone telephone. These are late adapters, late adapters. Oh, they plan to be computer literate sometime, but as far as they're concerned, it's as though it's happening to someone else. It's like the story of Ole and Sven. They're coming over from the old country on a ship, and the ship gets into the North Atlantic, and it's plunging and pitching up and down and up and down. And Ole comes running to Sven. He says, Sven, he says, the ship, she's breaking up. She's going down. He says, what do we care? It's not our ship. There's an enormous number of people who say, looking at all these changes that are taking place in our society, say, what do we care? It's not our ship. The interesting thing about a democracy that most people miss completely, I mean, they don't teach us much in school anymore anyway, is that everybody has equal vote. Everybody has an equal say in our society. Your vote is as powerful as the vote of the most powerful person in the world. No one else can outvote you. You have a single vote. Everybody else has a single vote. Most remarkable thing. And surprisingly enough, most people take it for granted, and the majority don't even use it. That's kind of scary. But the fact is that you have tremendous power. You are not a pawn. You have tremendous power. You can do remarkable things. And the good news is we have never been in a better time in all of human history than we are in right now. This is the best time in all of human history to be alive. We are entering into a golden age of peace and prosperity that has been dreamed about through all the histories of man. There are no wars even on the horizons, except for brush fires in third world countries. Basically, all the major powers are at peace, and the economies of all the major powers are expanding at an exponential rate. Do you know what that means? It means there's never been a better time for you to enjoy more of the things that make life wonderful than right now here in San Jose, California, in this state, in this country. It's never been better in all of human history. I mean, this is a wonderful time to be alive. I was talking to a good friend of mine in Nashville last week, and we were talking about the Renaissance. And the Renaissance was after 1,000 years of the Dark Ages in Europe, when art and music and poetry and sculpture and literature just flourished and bloomed in Europe. And he made the interesting point. He said, when the Renaissance was on, he said, most of the people walking along had no idea they were in the Renaissance. Years later, we look back and we study that historical period. But the people who were there at the time just went on. It's not their ship. And at a time when the greatest flourishing of wealth and art and music and everything that could possibly be dreamed of in the human condition at that time was going on, they were just walking along. Not our ship. Not affecting us. Interesting. USA Today has a study on millionaires. I have been studying the subject myself for many years. And the conclusion that USA Today has come to is the same conclusion I've come to. I've done more of the research than they have, I'm happy to say. And there's more research, but basically the rule is that there have never been more self-made millionaires than today in all of human history, and the rate is increasing exponentially. When I began studying this subject in 1980-81, there were about 1.7 million self-made millionaires in the United States. Today, there's about 3.8 million. In 1981, the rate of growth, someone was becoming a self-made millionaire every about 8.5 minutes. Today, it's one every 4.5 minutes. And according to Dr. Thomas Stanley and Business Week and USA Today, the number of self-made millionaires in America will double and even triple in the next 10 years. It is absolutely phenomenal what is taking place. 3.5% of American families have a net worth in excess of $1 million. When I started, it was less than 1%. 3.5%. It will soon be as high as 14% of American families will be millionaires. People say, well, yeah, well, it's not worth as much as it used to be. It's worth enough, you know. Now, if I were to ask you what your financial goals were when you were young, your goal was to be a millionaire by the time you were 30. That's the American dream. Become a millionaire by the time you're 30, have one of your children become president. In fact, we all want to be as successful as we possibly can. And the wonderful thing is that there are no limits today. There have been limits in the past. 100 years ago, there were a few couple of thousand self-made millionaires in America. Today, there's hundreds of thousands of millions of them. And they all started with nothing. Many of them started with no language skills and no money, and no contacts, and no friends. And they came here from foreign countries, and they didn't have a you-know-what to you-know-what in or a window to throw it out of. And yet they, by applying themselves, were able to accomplish extraordinary things. The critical sources of value today are knowledge and time. Knowledge. Brain power. Dr. Harlow Shapley of Harvard says that we have entered into the psychozoic age, the age of the mind. You can start off with nothing but your ability to think and apply your mind to your world, and if you do it and you do it well, your entire life will be different. I was having dinner with a group of business people here in San Jose about last August. It was a very high-level dinner. I've been running a conference at the university for them, and they were having a dinner in a Chinese restaurant, and the person who had organized it invited a couple of his friends. And the person who organized was Matt Fong, who's the treasurer of the state of California. And one of his friends was a little Chinese gentleman. He was seated next to me. Now, I was the facilitator for this. I mean, I'm kind of a serious person here. And so I was at the head table. Jack Kemp was also at the head table with me. And here's this fellow next to me. I try to make polite conversation. Hi, how are you doing? Fine, I'm doing fine. What do you do? Electronic, I mean electronic business. Oh, good. Electronic business, Sony Walkmans, television sets, low margin, high volume, very competitive, crazy Charlie, going out of business every 6 months. You know, I'm thinking, I'm trying to figure out, well, that's good. How's it going? Oh, very competitive, he said. Very difficult. Well, I knew that. Probably lives upstairs with his family, little shop downstairs, sells Sony Walkmans, you know, things like that. And I'm looking around thinking, this is a great conversation. We're not going anywhere, so I'm looking around for someone else to talk to. No one else to talk to, so I turn back to my dinner compartment. I say, well, how long have you been in the business? How'd you get into the electronics business? Let's make conversation. He said, well, I come over from Taiwan, he said, about 16 years ago with scholarship to Stanford. I said, oh, that's interesting, yeah. So he said, I graduated from Stanford Engineering, magna cum laude, about 13, 14 years ago, and two friends of mine and I, we start a little electronic business. I said, oh, and it's going well? He said, yeah, this year we passed $1 billion, he said. We have 2,000 employees. We passed $1 billion. Have everybody met or heard of John Wu, who just sold out his company and gave several $100 million to his employees, passed it out in bonuses and so on? Well, this was the gentleman. He had arrived over here, and he'd walked up to customs. And he could walk up to customs with nothing in his hands, no suitcase, and with the ability to create a $1 billion business in his brain, he could say, nothing to declare. And he could walk in here with $1 billion worth of wealth creation in his brain. Nothing to declare. You could lose everything that you have in the entire world, but as long as you still have your brain power, you can make it all back again and even more. My friend Jim Rohn says, becoming a self-made millionaire is wonderful for the money's purpose, but it is the person you have to become that is the most important of all. Because to become an exemplary person financially, you must become an exemplary person. One of the turning points in my life, and one of the most important principles I ever learned, and I try not to repeat myself, and if I do repeat myself in the course of this seminar, it must be an important point. You know, if the Bible repeats something, it must be important. Well, it's a law, it's called the law of correspondence. And the law of correspondence goes back to 3,000 years before Christ. And what it says is, as within, so without. As within, so without. It says that your outer world is a reflection of your inner world. That here's you, and here's your outer, and this is you, and your outer world is like a 360-degree mirror. That wherever you look, you see yourself reflected back. As we say, wherever you go, there you are. That your outer world reflects your inner world. And this has been one of the great truths of all of human history. It's the basis of all religion, all metaphysics, all psychiatry, psychology, philosophy. It says that if you can change your inner world, if you can change what is going on inside your mind, you can dramatically change what is going on the outside. And there is no other way. Your outer world merely expresses your thoughts, thinking, feeling, hopes, goals, dreams, and so on. What do we know about successful people? The successful people are very clear about who they are and what they want. And unsuccessful people are very fuzzy and confused. And we will talk about this over the next couple of days. Tomorrow, we're going to spend an enormous amount of time on goal setting. Today, we're going to spend an enormous amount of time on getting our thinking so that it parallels where we want to be tomorrow. But this law of correspondence says that your relationships, your health, your income, every part of your life merely reflects on a one-to-one basis. It reflects back to you the way you think. Everything you have in your life, you've attracted to yourself because of the person you are. You can change the aspects of your life because you can change the person that you are. William James of Harvard in 1905 said, "The greatest revolution of my generation is the discovery that the average person, by changing their inner attitudes of mind, can change the outer aspects of their lives." But the flip side is, there's no other way. We cannot change our external world except by changing our internal world, and you have total 100% control over your internal world. As a result, you have total control over your future destiny. You could become anything that you really, really want to become if you will simply change so that the way you think on the inside is completely in harmony with what you want to enjoy on the outside. You cannot be angry, unhappy, and frustrated, and ignorant on the inside and have a successful, happy, affluent life on the outside. But if you are fully integrated internally, your outer world will change, and I promise you, before this course is over, you will begin to see profound changes in your external world. Because in this course, you will change, because your thinking will change. As a result, other things will change like a mirror. The world is full of people who go to the mirror of life, and they look into it, and they don't like the reflection. So they pound the mirror. They try to change the mirror. They're frustrated. They curse the mirror, which is the equivalent of trying to change the external world, instead of going to work on themselves. By the way, here's a rule. It's not in this course. I'll give it to you. It's free. Except in miraculous situations, people don't change. People take their entire lives to get to where they are today, so they don't change. What does that mean? It means that if any part of your success or happiness is dependent upon somebody changing, then you're living in cloud cuckoo land. People don't change. And one of the dumbest things that we can do is hang all of our hopes on impossible things taking place, like the Alice in Wonderland mentality. I can believe two impossible things before breakfast every morning. No. So we have to be very, very honest with ourselves. We'll talk about that later. Well, when I began my career many years ago, I began asking the question, why is it that some people are more successful than others? And I had come from a very poor background. I didn't have any money. I was uneducated. I was unskilled, and I was unemployed. I slept in my car. I was homeless before it was respectable. I drifted. I worked at laboring jobs. I worked on farms and ranches. I washed dishes in small hotels. I slept in my car. I slept on the ground. I dug wells at one time. That's where you start at ground level and work down rather than up. And when you succeed, you fail, because when you find water, they fire you. Not a great incentive system. What's that? Looks like water. Well, cover it up. We need two more days' work. Anyway. So I was really curious to know, why is it that some people had more money and had nicer homes and were healthier and happier and drove nicer cars and went to nice restaurants and got into the magazines and stayed in nice hotels like this? And so I began to study it. In the Bible, there's a wonderful little thing that says, seek and ye shall find, for all who seek findeth. Now, that's a remarkable little principle. You notice that if the Bible is true, which we believe it is true, you notice it doesn't say seek and you may turn up something every so often. It's a very clear statement, one of the most important of all. It says, seek and ye shall find. All of you are seekers, by the way. And the world, the future belongs to the seekers. The future belongs to those who seek, and you're here to seek. It's a most remarkable thing. And if you do seek, you will find. And in the course of the next 2 days, you will find a lot of remarkable things. Because I'll share with you not only practical principles for success, but I'll share with you some of my philosophy and some of the things I've learned over the years and over the miles in a variety of different circumstances. But I was looking for the question, and people say, well, all you care about is money. When you say success, you're only concerned about money. Well, people who say that they're not concerned about money, as we know, will lie about other things as well. But if you really want to look at success, success is composed of four ingredients. And the first of ingredient is health and energy. You basically measure how well you're doing as a person by how healthy you are and how much energy you have. And by the way, these are the two critical concerns today. And today we have longevity and health by design, not by accident. Today you can live to be 80 years, 90 years old. 79.6 is the average for women. The average, that means half die above it, half below. That's the average. If you just hit the average, you'll have the longest lifespan that anybody's ever imagined having in all of human history. It's wonderful. For men, the lifespan is a little bit shorter, about 5 years shorter, because men do a lot more foolish things and die off earlier. And women, as my wife says, women like to live. And they're very determined to live. So men drive faster, they drink more, they engage in more precarious activities. Women are a little bit more concerned about the long haul. So health and energy is really important, and health and energy is a deficiency need. If you have it, you don't think about it. If you don't have it, you think about it all the time. So number two is loving relationships. And loving relationships are terribly important. Once your health is taken care of, once you are no longer worried about your health, your relationships become paramount. That's the wonderful thing about a fully integrated human being, is that their relationships are central to their lives. A person who is confused sees relationships as peripheral, like planets going around a sun, coming back into orbit every so often. The truly integrated person sees relationships as central, with the aspects of their lives as the planets that go around them. So relationships are terribly important, and we know that we are only successful to the degree to which we have excellent relationships. And the third ingredient for success is meaningful work. This is work that you do and that you do well. It's work that makes a difference in the world. It answers what Sidney Bugenthal called man's need for significance, or what Viktor Frankl called man's need for meaning and purpose. Each of us has to know that what we do counts, makes a difference. Nothing worse in the entire world than to be doing something that you feel doesn't really matter. By the way, people who are working at things that are proper for them never think of retiring. People who think of retiring are just basically saying, I just want to get away from this as soon as I can, because it's destroying my soul. And one of the most important responsibilities we have as adults is to make very sure that what we're doing really makes a difference. And that's up to us. And we'll talk about that as we go along. And number four, the fourth ingredient of success, which we all have in common, is financial independence. Now, financial independence is very interesting, We need enough so that we don't worry about money. We need to have enough money so that we don't worry about it. Don't think about it. It's something else. We can go into the restaurant and we can order without looking at the right-hand column to see how hungry we are. We need to have enough so that we don't worry. And everyone has to decide how much that is. But here's the most wonderful thing. It's never been more possible for you to have enough than now. They say that the baby boom generation will inherit something like $20 trillion. And so half the money in the world will just be passed on in the next few decades by our parents. I mean, it's phenomenal. We have tremendous wealth. The government is trying to tax it away. By the way, I have an important point. Is you've heard the expression, the rich must pay their fair share. You've heard that? Rich is a political term, completely devoid of meaning. It's used as a form of class warfare. It's really irrelevant because rich should actually mean hardworking and highly productive. That's basically what rich people are, because in the studies of the rich that I've done for 25 years, they're some of the hardest working people you can imagine. They work anywhere from 59 average to 70, 80 hours a week, and they work for 20 to 30 years before they achieve financial independence at that level. They have invested 5 to 10 times as much in personal education, and they have scrimped and saved sometimes for decades to get to the point where they have some money put aside. Now, these, by the way, are good qualities. Self-discipline, self-denial, hard work, delayed gratification, honesty, integrity, savings. These are things to be encouraged, not to be punished by our existing taxes. And the real question is, how can we start teaching people from the first grade up how they can achieve financial independence? Teach them really well so that they can get a good education, so they can grow up, so they can make a good living, so they can do work that really makes a difference, so they can do it really well, so they can get paid well, and then teach them how to hold on to the money on the way through. That's what we should be focusing on, not punishing those who, in spite of all the odds, have become successful. We've got our priorities. Okay, let us begin. Now, here's the turning point for me, because I looked at people who were successful, and I thought it was age and education and experience, and I thought they had blessings and family money and so on. But what I found was that success is 80% psychological. It's the 80-20 rule. Success is 80% psychological. And it's only 20% technical. Now, technical skills are very important. They're the foundation of self-confidence, self-esteem, belief in your abilities. You must have them. But 80% of success is psychological. And if you can get this 80%, you will get the other 20% as well. By the way, quick question. How many people here are in sales? Okay, we're all in sales. Even those of you who do not raise your hands, you are in sales as well. Everybody is in sales. Everybody's in the business of communicating, negotiating, persuading, and influencing other people. Is that correct? We are all in sales. We have a choice in sales. We can either be good at it or poor at it. People who aren't good at it keep their hands down. People who are good at it raise their hands. I'm in sales. I'm damn good. And so therefore, we're all in sales. And we will talk about selling and how these principles apply to selling. And they start right off with session number one. Are you ready? Say yes.
Yes.
All right. Session number one is 7 qualities of master achievers. The 7 qualities of master achievers, and by the way, we've studied psychologically, psychographically, the most successful people in our society, and here's what we found by the law of correspondence, that if you think the way the very best people do, what will happen? You'll get the results that the very best people get, and that is the surest way to do it. And the wonderful thing is you can change your thinking almost overnight. You can change it quickly and start getting different results quickly. Your outer world always reflects your inner world. This is the most incredible thing. You can start from nowhere. You can have nothing. You can have had a whole life full of thumb-sucking and complaints and problems and everything else. And at this moment, you can decide, from this moment onward, I will think differently about myself and my possibilities. And wham, your life will change. America is a great country. It's the most forgiving country in history. And I'll tell you why. In almost every other country I go to, who your parents were, who your background was, who your grandparents were, is a matter of great significance. I was in Cork, Ireland, which is a 410,000 second major city in Ireland, recently doing a talk. And they were telling me, everybody in Cork, he said, the Southern Ireland, they say, who was your parents? Who was your father? Who was your mother? Who were they? And who were they? And what were their lineage? And what were their parents? And what did their grandparents do? They said, nobody is anybody by themselves. They are only an extension of their parents. And I thought, isn't that the most remarkable thing? Here, that's nonsense. Nobody cares who you were. If you came from anywhere, if you had any kind of a background at all we care is how you are right now to me. That's all we care about. My children are always asking me, I have four young children from 5, 10, 14, and 17. I told them all the time. I said, the only way you ever judge a person is by the way they treat you. That's the only measure of a person. No other factor is relevant except that the way they treat you. And if they are good to you and they're decent to you, then they are good people. And if they're not, I'll be mad at them. We don't care who people are or where they came from. We only care who they are at this moment to us. So you can change anytime. Now, here are the qualities that we have found are characteristic of the most successful people in our society, and especially the most successful people in selling. Number one, they're ambitious. They see themselves capable of being the best. They see themselves capable of being the best. Now, what does that mean? It means that you see yourself with the capacity of being really good at what you do. Now, this was a really big thought for me. It was kind of overwhelming because it held me back for many years. When I saw people who were doing better than I was, I naturally assumed that they were better than I was. And if they were better than I was, then I must be worse than them. So that would mean that they were superior and I was inferior. And that is the big problem we have in our society. We have feelings of inferiority. And these feelings of inferiority are often translated into feelings of undeservingness. We don't feel that we deserve to be a big success. And there are a lot of people schooled in the old school who, if you are successful, say, well, don't you feel guilty, you know, in living that kind of life and buying those sort of things and having a nice car when there's so many poor people in the world? You know, have you ever had this? People try to make you feel guilty for being successful. Well, you should. Don't you feel a little bit guilty doing what you want to do and going where you want to go? Absolutely not. And I will tell you why. It's because the word deserve comes from two Latin words meaning from, de, service. So the word deserve means from service. You deserve 100% of everything that you make and enjoy as long as you get it from serving other people. If you don't want to serve other people, you go to work for the government. And then you don't have to please anyone. They say civil service is an oxymoron. It's neither civil nor is it service. You don't have to do anything for anybody and you can never get fired. And you have one of the most generous pay plans and pension plans in the world. That's why people go to work for the government. So, but you and I are different. We believe in earning what we earn from service. So the only question really is how can you increase the value of your service? That's what you want. All you think about is how can I increase the value of my service so that I can simultaneously increase the quantity of my rewards. Your rewards are a direct relationship, direct proportion to your service. If you serve more and serve better and serve at a higher level and serve more enthusiastically and serve higher quality, then you will have a wonderful life and by gum, you deserve every penny of it. And you can be happy. If somebody says, don't you feel guilty? You say, not a whit. I don't feel guilty at all. I enjoy it. So here's something that changed my life when I was a young man. And by the way, I talk about ambitious and seeing yourself capable of being the best a lot at this point because it's so important. You must see yourself capable of being the best, being the best. You see, this seminar, in its simplest terms, has been designed for the top 10%. And it has a kind of a self-selection mechanism. The statistics show us that only the top 10% of people come to these seminars. Actually, probably a smaller percentage than that, maybe closer to 5%. There's all kinds of statistics. How many people will take a half-day seminar, a full-day seminar, a two-day seminar, three-day seminar? But less than 10% of adults in their entire lives will seek out an experience like this. Less than 10%. And they're always, always and invariably the top 10%. Now remember, it's not necessarily where they are today. Some of you are saying, well, if you knew how much I was making, you know, you wouldn't say I was in the top 10%. I will give you one of the great rules for success. It is this. It doesn't matter where you're coming from. All that matters is where you're going. And the very fact that you're here means that's where you're going. And you see, it's not where you're going theoretically. Here's a good question. How can you tell who a person really is? What's the true measure? There's only one true measure. Is it what they say? Is it what they wish? Is it what they hope? Is it what they intend? It's their actions. You can only tell who a person truly is by looking at what they do when they have to choose. Look at what they do under pressure. Look at what they do when the chips are down. Epictetus, the Greek philosopher, said, circumstances do not make the man. They merely reveal him to himself and to others, for that matter. So therefore, we reveal who we are by what we do. People tell themselves and others who they are by what they do when they have to choose. Do they choose to sit in the office and to read the newspaper, drink coffee, and complain about business? Do they choose to watch television? Do they choose to go to happy hour and so on? What people do is the expression of who they are. So, if the top 10% of people come to seminars like this, and you have come to this seminar, what can we safely conclude? That you must be in the top 10%, consciously or unconsciously. You see, some people are consciously in the top 10%. They know it. And some people are unconsciously there because they're moving toward it. It doesn't really matter, because you must get there in your mind before you get there in your reality. Your mind must get there long before your reality gets there. Your mind must be crystal clear about where you're going, and you know, consciously or unconsciously. I've just brought it to a higher level of awareness that wherever you are now, this seminar is for the top 10%. Because if you are in the top 10%, great. And if you're not, you will soon be there. And there's nothing that can keep you out of the top 10%. So this is what I found was quite remarkable, because I looked and I noticed that the top 10% of people enjoy all the rewards. The top 10% of people own the future. The top 10% of people are who the other 80, 90% work for and work to support. The top 10% of Americans, by the way, make about 60, 70% of the income. The top 10% of Americans, according to the IRS, pay 57% of all the income taxes. When they talk about paying their fair share, do you know how much the bottom 50% pay of all the income taxes collected in America? Do you know how much the bottom 50% pay, the ones that aren't, that need to be helped? About 4%. The bottom 50% of income earners in America pay 4% of the taxes. The top 10% pay 57%. These are the ones that have to pay their fair share by having taxes raised. Excuse me. So, this is what I learned, because I drifted for a long time, and even if I did well, I would always make excuses, because, geez, I can't, there's got to be a reason for that. And then I learned two remarkable things. Remarkable thing number one is that everybody has the capacity to be excellent at something. Everybody has the capacity to be excellent at something. We are engineered with it. Now, you say, well, what about the hopeless person who's got Down syndrome and is multi-crippled and has multiple sclerosis and is mentally retarded? The weakest form of argument is to argue from extremes. Whenever you find yourself arguing from extremes, you say, well, I'm obviously mentally defective, because, because we don't argue from extremes. We look at the 95% main, and we put the tails of the distribution aside for the sake of generating general principles, right? A general principle is, if you drive safely and carefully on the right-hand side and you drive the speed limit and you stop at stop signs and red lights, you probably won't have any trouble in driving. That's about 95% true, right? Okay, so that's where we keep our minds. So we know that just about everybody can be excellent at something. But here was the real mind shifter for me, is I learned that everybody who's in the top 10% started in the bottom 10%. Everybody's at the top, start at the bottom. Everyone who's at the front of the line started at the back of the line. And when I realized that, I realized, wow, you mean all I have to do is find out how people got from the back of the line to the front of the line and do the same things that they did, and I'll get the same result? Duh. Yes. It's what Socrates called, in 425 BC, the principle of causality, what we call the law of cause and effect. What it says is that for every effect, there's a cause. That we live in a universe governed by law, not by chance. If you can define the effect that you want to be in the top 10% and have all the rewards and esteem and respect and security that goes with it, then you find someone else who started off in the bottom 10%, find out what they did, do the same things, and if you do the same things, you get the same results. Not a miracle. It's not selective. It's not discriminatory. Anybody can do it. Why is it that new immigrants to this country, become self-made millionaires at four times the rate of native-born Americans? Four times. They have a 400% greater chance of becoming self-made millionaires. 35% of Russian homes in America are self-made millionaire homes. 35%. Highest rate, off the clock. Now, there are not a lot of Russians, but their rate of entrepreneurship and financial success is extraordinary. Why? Boy, yes, because the system they came from is so repressive, and they get here, this is easy. Geez, they've never seen it so easy to make money. They say the money lays on the streets in America, and the average American walks by and complains about their bills. The opportunities are just flooding like a gusher, like a torrent, like a flood. There's so many opportunities here. The average person who comes from a place where they've been starved for opportunities sees them everywhere. The average person just goes by on their way home to watch television. And the reason why immigrants are more successful than Americans, my friend Zig said this to me the other day. He said, well, when they get here, they can't read all that negative stuff in the press. By the time he said, by the time they learn how to read, he said, they're already wealthy. Got a great advantage going for them. Ben Wattenberg said, the good news is that the bad news is wrong. Even at a time when our economy is booming, the ratio will be 7-1, negative stories to positive stories. Don't you believe them. Don't you believe them. Booms, busts, recessions, depressions. Economists are those who predicted 18 of the last two recessions. The point is that everybody can get into the top 10%. All you have to do is put one foot in front of another until you get there, and there's nothing that will stop you. There are no rules anywhere that say, I'm sorry, you can't go any further than that, and you are in the bottom 60%, and you may be in the top 10%. There's no rules. The fact of the matter is that I promise you, I have seen every single type of person with every conceivable limitation you could ever dream of who has put one foot in front of the other because they're clear, I want to be in the top 10%. Now, you can't hit a target that you can't see. So what you do is you say, okay, what does the top 10% represent in my field? How much do people in the top 10% make? Good, that's my target. Now, how much do they sell to get into that top 10%? How much do they make per sale? So how many sales do I have to make to get into that? And how many calls do I have to make that many sales? And so on, and you work it all the back. Now, what do I have to do right now, this minute, to get from where I am to where I want to go? And then you put one foot in front of another, and as sure as God made little green apples, you'll get there. And everybody will turn around and say, boy, you sure are lucky. Isn't that right? That's the most incredible thing. They're busy watching television. You sure were lucky. You just stumbled into that job after 18 years of breaking your back and blowing your brains out and hard work and saving every single penny when I was blowing every penny I could and a little bit more besides on my credit cards, and now you're financially successful. Geez, you should share. You should pay your fair share. Okay. Do you know what Gephardt? Now, Gephardt is the second. Gore and Gephardt are going to contend for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States in the year 2000. Do you know what Gephardt said recently? Now, this will give you an idea of the way they think. This is the sort of thing that gets standing ovations from those people. He said, those who have been lucky at the gaming table of life should be forced to share their winnings with those who have been less fortunate. So their mentality is that any success that you enjoy is pure luck. It's pure chance. You all stepped up to the gaming table of life and rolled the dice. You rolled some good numbers, and the other people who are at home watching television rolled poor numbers, but therefore you are not entitled to what you earned through years and years and years of hard work. It should be taken away from you and shared with the others who didn't do so well at the great gaming table of life. This is their philosophy. The inmates have taken over the asylum. Okay. Here's my second point. The top 20% earn 80% of the money. The top 20% in selling make 80% of the sales. The top 20% of companies in any business earn 80% of the profits. The top 20% of people earn 80% of the money. And they earn 80% of the money for a variety of reasons, which you will soon learn. Number two quality of top people is they're courageous. They're courageous. They work to confront the fears that hold most people back. You see, the two biggest enemies to yours and my success are fear and doubt. And we'll talk about this extensively throughout the course, because if you could eliminate your fear so you weren't afraid of anything, and if you could eliminate your self-doubt so you had the kind of confidence that was unshakable, then you could accomplish extraordinary things. And I'll show you systematically how to do that. It's like saying, I'll show you how to type with a typewriter. Because developing the psychological qualities of success is a process that has been refined by hundreds of thousands and millions of people over decades. And I'll show you what they are. Really simple, powerful principles. So eliminating fear and doubt is the key. Now, what is the key to eliminating fear? How do we develop courage? Aristotle, who was perhaps the greatest of philosophers, coined a word called praxis. Now, praxis is actually a Greek word which means taking the action consistent with the desired end. It means this. If you want to develop courage, then simply act courageously when it's called for. And if you do something over and over again repeatedly, what do you develop? you develop a habit. So people develop the habit of courage, and people develop the habit of non-courage, if you like, by simply engaging in the actions repeatedly that lead to one or the other. Now, I'm not meaning to be simplistic, but that is very simplistic. So what do we know? And this is what Aristotle said. If you desire a quality and you have it not, act in every respect as if you already had the quality you desire, and you will have it. Ralph Waldo Emerson said when he was 12 years old, a little piece of paper blew against his leg when he was walking down the street in Concord, Massachusetts, and it changed his life forever. And he picked up the little piece of paper and he looked at it and it said, "If you would be happy and successful," he said, "make a habit throughout your life of doing the things you fear. Make a habit throughout your life of doing the things you fear." You see, if you do the thing you fear, the death of fear is certain. If you do the thing you fear, the death of fear is certain. Because if you keep doing the thing you fear, eventually it has no fear for you. So therefore, what is the one major reason why people fail in selling? It's because they hate prospecting. Why do they hate prospecting? Because of the fear of rejection, criticism, disapproval, and so on. So what do most people do when they have a fear? Is they avoid that area. And by avoiding the area of prospecting, their business declines, which makes them more fearful and anxious for the rest of their lives, which makes them avoid rejection and prospecting even more, and one-third of all salespeople every year drop out of selling because they cannot take the trauma and the fear involved in prospecting. What do top salespeople do? They say, "I am going to do this prospecting. I'm going to hammer and hammer at it until I am completely neutral." So it has no fear at all. What's the great rule for overcoming the fear of rejection in prospecting? The answer is to realize that rejection is not personal. The key is rejection is not personal. Rejection in selling is not personal. I had a friend who started in selling some years ago, and he was very, very anxious about prospecting. He had to prospect on the telephone, and he found himself doing the telephone two-step. You know what the telephone two-step is? Here's the telephone. And you have to phone to make appointments. Now, how many of us have to phone to make appointments? Come on, we all have to use the phone. He'd go, "Well, how are you doing?" "Well, I think I'll have another cup of coffee." "Did you get any calls yet?" "No, you didn't send any calls out." "Okay." We've all done that. And he realized that his fear of picking up the phone and calling on prospects was sabotaging his career right from the beginning. So he went out to a local stationery store, got a big roll of masking tape, came back, masking taped the telephone to his hand. And he would not let himself off, get a cup of coffee, or even go to the bathroom until he had filled up his calendar for the next day. And he would just telephone. And he finally got to the point where he's more preoccupied with other needs than prospecting. And he kept phoning and phoning until he had a full slate of appointments. And only then would he take the tape off. Within 6 months, he was the top salesman in his company. And all the others who had laughed at him had all gone out and bought their own rolls of tape. So, play games with yourself. Do what it takes. Push yourself, force yourself, face your fears, confront your fears. Do the things that you fear. Remember, the ability to confront your fears is the mark of the superior person. And if you have high ambition and you decide to be in the top 10% and you can confront your fears and do the things that are holding you back, those two things alone will make you a great success. We can stop and all go home right now if you could just practice those two things. By the way, the most important part of this course is not what you learn, but what you do afterwards. So at the end of every session, we're going to stop and we're going to have an action commitment. And you are going to write down in the present tense something that you are going to do specifically differently from what you would have done in the absence of what we just learned. And you always write in the present tense, "I am, I can, I earn, I do," rather than "I will," or "next week." Never write in the future, because the subconscious mind only registers in the present tense. Always write in the now as though it were already a fact. You'll see what a difference this makes. Okay, number three is committed. The top people in every field, especially the top salespeople, are completely committed. They don't dabble with their fingertips in the birdbath of life. They believe in themselves. They believe in their companies. They believe in their products and services. They believe in their customers. They believe. They have an intense belief. We know there's a one-to-one relationship between the depth of your belief and what happens in your reality. And if you absolutely believe in the rightness and goodness of what you're doing, you become like a catalyst. You create what is called a transfer, like an electrical transfer of enthusiasm. People like to buy from people who really believe in the goodness of what they're doing. Have you ever been out to shop and you walked out and you said, you know, that person couldn't have cared less if they sold us that? That person could not have cared less. I was in a restaurant yesterday and the waitress could not have cared less about the food. She even brought us the bill for a table next to us that had twice as many people as we did. I said, this is the wrong bill. It's twice as high. Oh, all right, I'll get you another bill. Well, great tragedy is people who are not committed to what they do lead very empty lives. And that's why it's so important. People say to me, you know, I really like my company, but I don't like the products and I don't like the people I have to sell to. What can I do to be successful? I say, sir, it's called the Q word. Quit. You'll never be successful unless you're selling something that you like and enjoy and believe in. University of Chicago study says that people don't buy the product or service as much as they buy your belief in the goodness of the product or service for them. That's why your customers will often ask you, do you think this is a good thing for me? Would you get this if you were in my situation? What would you do if you were in my... They will always ask you. They're trying to confirm. Now, they only ask you that, by the way, if they like and respect your opinion. If they like and respect your opinion, they'll ask you for your judgment, is this good for me? What they want to know is, do you believe in it? If I believe in you and you believe in the product, then I'll buy the product. Very important. So committed, they believe. Transfer of enthusiasm, because we know, and this is the second part, is that caring is the critical element in modern selling. Caring is a critical element in life as well. All men and women who enjoy great lives care about what they do. They are impassioned about what they do. They love what they do. And it's very important. Love what you do. And you'll find that the very top salespeople are always people who really care about the goodness of what they're representing for their customers. Why is it that women are rising to the top of every major sales field in America? It's because they recognize the critical, the central nature of caring, the emotional component. Remember, humans are 100% emotional. When we believe that you really care about this for us and our lives and work being better by using this product or service, when you're really excited about what it is you're selling, when we feel that chemical catalyst, we want to buy. We're much more likely to buy than if we feel that you're just going through the motions. So therefore, caring is very important. And we'll talk about this, but it means asking good questions and listening carefully to the answers and making it clear that you care more about the customer than the product. By the way, do you know how the top 10% of salespeople are described? In those very words. Do your customers ever say to you, you know, I get the impression that you care more about my situation than about selling your product? You ever heard that? Has anybody heard that? It means you're in the top 10%. Because in our studies of customers, they're always saying this about the top 10% of salespeople. Because the top 10% of salespeople genuinely feel that way. They would not sell something to someone that wasn't right for them. Number four is professional. Top salespeople are professional. They see themselves as consultants rather than as salespeople. Let me ask you a question. When you think of the word consultant, what words come to mind? Okay, caring is very good. What else? Expert, and consultant is an expert, really knows their material inside and out. What else? Good listeners. Good. When do you call a consultant in? When you have a? So a good consultant is a? Problem solver. What else? A friend? What else? Knowledgeable? What other words come to mind when you think of a consultant? Objective. Objective, of course. Objective. A coach? Independent? That's right. That's an advisor, a counselor, a friend, a teacher, and so on. Now, you notice when we switch to talking about consultants, what word did not appear? Salesperson. What happened to the word salesperson? Just didn't appear. Why is that? It's because we don't think of consultants as salespeople, even though I have worked with countless consulting firms where I've done work on how to sell professional services. I have a library of books on selling professional services. The most successful consultants in America are the very best salespeople of their services. But a person positioned as a consultant in the mind and heart of the customer is not seen as a salesperson. Do people like to be sold? Do people like to be helped to improve their lives and work? So they look upon a salesperson as someone who sells them. Do you know that the verb to sell is a transitive verb? Does anyone know what, or remember what a transitive verb is? A transitive verb is a verb that takes an object. It means selling is something that you do to someone. And people don't like to be done to. So when you think of being a consultant, here's the key. And this had a profound effect on me because it's so simple. Is how do you position yourself as a consultant with your customers? Of course, you act like a consultant, but even before you get a chance to act like a consultant, how? Building rapport? Yes, that's very important. And I'll tell you the simplest answer of all. I learned it when I was 23. I couldn't believe it. Here is a profound principle. People accept you at your own evaluation of yourself. If you tell me that you fly jet fighters on the weekends, I say, okay, I accept that. I'm not going to argue with you. I'm not going to beat you up and demand to see your badge or your flight log. If you say that you're a marathon runner, and if you say that you're a nuclear scientist, and you say that you design web pages, and you say that you're a speed reader, and you say that you're a consultant, I accept that. We always accept people at their own evaluation of themselves, even if we're skeptical, and then we just watch and wait and see how you behave. And if you say that you're a consultant, then I'll say, oh, you're a consultant. Sorry, I thought you were but please come in and have a cup of coffee. Consultants come in and have a cup of coffee. The salespeople wait in the waiting room and have a glass of water. You see, if you say you're a consultant, your customer will accept you as a consultant. So say, Mr. Customer, thank you very much for your time. I'm not really here to sell you anything today. I want you to be assured of that. I see myself more as a consultant. And what I would like to do is ask you some questions, if I could, and see if we can't help you achieve some of your goals. But I really don't see myself as a salesperson. I see myself more as a consultant. Oh, you see yourself as a consultant? Okay, I accept you as a consultant. So from now on, position yourself as a consultant. Think of yourself as a consultant. Remember, 80% of what you accomplish on the outside is determined by who you are on the inside. If you see yourself as a consultant, if you see yourself as an advisor, a friend, a problem solver, a good listener, a knowledgeable, objective, independent counselor helping a person to achieve some of their goals, it's very different than selling a product or service, although the end result is the same. Are you with me so far? It's very important. How you see yourself determines how the customer responds to you. If the customer thinks of you as a consultant, then here's what we know. The top 10% of salespeople of all products, even people who sell cafe latte at the local Starbucks, are seen as consultants, advisors, and friends. Why do you buy from her and continue to buy from her? Well, I see her more as a consultant than as a salesperson. And I feel that she's really trying to help me improve my situation rather than trying to sell me a product or service. Ah, because the customer's perception of you is determined by your perception of yourself, and the customer's perception of you determines how much they buy and how much they recommend and refer you to others. Are you with me so far? This is very important. It's so simple, but it's terribly important because it is the hallmark of the highest earning people in selling. So see yourself as a consultant. I'm a consultant. Thank you very much. Number five is prepared. They review every detail in advance. Now, to be in the top 10% requires additional efforts. It requires doing things that the average person is not willing to do. It requires making sacrifices that the average person is not willing to make. It requires starting a little bit earlier and working a little harder and staying a little bit later. It requires reviewing every detail of every call or situation before every business meeting. But the difference it makes is extraordinary. Do your homework. When you go in to a business meeting, do your homework. I am used often as a facilitator and a consultant to corporations and organizations here and even in Washington, D.C. And often they will ask me to do something, and I will say, well, I will agree to do it. Send me the background information. It may take me 10, 12 hours of reading and taking notes in the background information to be ready for a 60-minute talk. But when I get up and begin to speak, everybody in the room knows that this person has done their homework. And I don't like to do this 10 or 12 hours of hard work, but I'm more concerned with the result than I am with the hard work. Herbert Gray, a businessman some years ago, spent 11 years searching for the common denominator of success. He said the common denominator of success is one thing. He said successful people are more concerned about pleasing results than they are about pleasing methods. They're more concerned about successful ends than happy means. My friend Dennis Waitley says they're more concerned with activities that are goal achieving rather than the average person who is preoccupied with activities that are tension relieving. Herbert Gray says this. He said, successful people are those who make a habit of doing what unsuccessful people don't like to do. And what are those things that unsuccessful people don't like to do? They're the same things that successful people don't like to do either. But the successful people do them because they're far more concerned about a successful result, and they recognize that what goes in determines what comes out. So it's very important. Whenever you find yourself over-preparing, the rule is earn the right. Do your homework. Earn the right. Review your notes. Go over it and over again. When you sit down with a client, there's nothing more rewarding, nothing more complimentary to a client than the feeling that you have prepared for this meeting. And nothing more insulting to a customer than the feeling that you're going to try to fool me by winging it. You're going to sit there and you're going to try to double talk me. I had a salesman come into my office. We had displayed at American Society for Training and Development. He had spoken to our people there, and he was in San Diego. He had arranged, he said, I'd like to talk to you about putting some of your courses into an interactive media form, which costs a lot of money, but it's a multi-billion dollar business. And so he called my office, he spoke to my vice president, went back and forth. They finally set up an appointment. And after 3 weeks of going back and forth, we finally had a meeting. I agreed to see him. Sure, absolutely. He came in, sat down, and he started talking. And he spoke for about 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes about himself and his business and what we should be doing and what the direction of our company should be and so on. Now, you can fool people for 1 or 2 minutes, but if you speak long enough, the holes in your knowledge begin to become glaringly obvious. And at about 5 or 6 minutes, I realized he didn't know anything about our business. He was telling us things that we should do that we had done 3 or 4 years ago. He was telling us things about our programs and products that could be done that we'd already done. He was giving us throwaway pieces of advice on things we might develop that had already been developed and were being sold worldwide. I realized he had not lifted a finger to learn anything about our business. And I said, whoa. It's about the 10 minute. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, how much do you know about our business and how much did you learn before you came in here? Oh, he said, well, I don't know anything about your business, but if you decide to buy from me, I'd be willing to find out. I said, that's incredible. I have my wife sitting there. That's incredible. Isn't that incredible? Did you hear that? That is worth the meeting just so I could relay this to audiences. I said, well, thank you very much. I won't take up another minute of your time. I said, you have committed the cardinal sin. You have called on an intelligent customer, and you have not made any effort at all to find out anything about my business. You had 3 weeks to set up this appointment. All of my material is available for the asking. Books, pamphlets, price lists, brochures, everything. You could have gotten any of this at any time and glanced through it, but you choose to walk in here not even knowing anything about us. I said, thank you very much. I took him to the door. I said, I wish you luck. He said, I sure hope we can get together again. I said, I don't think so. Now, many of your customers will say, thank you very much for coming in. Let me think it over. And they've just said, made the same statement. I don't think so. I don't think I'll think it over, nor will we ever meet again. Because why? You weren't prepared. So be prepared. People say, boy, it sure is hard to be successful. Really? Try failing in life. That's really hard. Number 6 is continuous learners. A characteristic is they're continuously learning. They recognize that the answers have changed. They recognize that whatever you know, it's becoming obsolete at an incredible rate. They recognize that if they're not continually getting better, they're getting worse. If they're not moving ahead, they're moving behind. Nobody is staying in the same place anymore. So they read continually. They read, they listen to audio tapes, and they take additional training. They read, they listen to audio tapes, and they take additional training. School is never out for the professional. The professional never stops learning. They learn voraciously. There are many people in their 50s going back to university to get degrees to start new careers today because they're going to live to be 75 or 80, and they're not going to retire. So they finish a degree at the age, I spoke to a woman recently, she had worked in nursing assistants. At the age of 42, her children were now out of high school. She went back to university in 7 years. At the age of 49, she completed a medical degree in pediatrics. People said, you must be kidding, you're 49 years old. I said, yes, but I know enough to know that my lifespan is about 79. That gives me 30 more years. I can probably practice pediatrics for 20 years. I mean, I can have a wonderful life. And they said, well, geez, you should, nonsense. And this is quite common. People are staying in school all their lives. Used to be that you got your education. Recently, when I was growing up, they used to say that you had three parts of life. You had your learning years, the first 20 or so, and then you had your earning years, the next 40 or 45, then you had your yearning years. Unfortunately, what happened is the yearning years have extended by about 10 or 15 years. When the Social Security system, by the way, was started, do you want to know why it's bankrupt? When it was started in 1935, you started collecting from it when you were 65 years of age. There were 72 people working for every one person collecting when it started. But the average lifespan of the average male in America was 62 years. So the system was a crapshoot. It was based on the fact that most people will die before they ever get to retirement. And so they looked at all the money that was being put in and they said, look, we're not going to have to pay this out. Let's just spend it. Let's buy some votes. If I give you a free swimming pool, a new health center, some roads and so on, will you vote for me next time? Sure. So they spent it all. So today what we have is a $17 trillion unfunded Social Security liability, and people are no longer dying at 62, they're dying at 80. That's why 100% of everything you put in your entire life is paid out in the first 2 years and 7 months of retirement. All the rest has to be paid out of taxes on those who are still working. And we have about three and a half to four people working. Used to be 72. We have 3.5 to 4 people working now for every person retired. In Germany, it's down to about 2 working for everyone that's retired. Every Western economy is bankrupt. Did you know that? Because we can't take the liability. We spent all the money. There is no Social Security trust fund. That's nonsense. It's all gone. They blew it. They spent it on us. You like this hotel? It's probably funded out of the Social Security trust fund. Anyway, I have a good friend who says our national debt is the government's way of giving our grandchildren an opportunity to invest in their past. Anyway, so re-listen to audio tapes, take continuous training, and don't ever expect that there will be anything left for you at the end of your work life if you have not personally put it away. Number 7, responsible. They see themselves as the presidents of their own personal services corporation. The top people in our society have an attitude of self-employment. How many people here are self-employed? And the answer is all of us. 100% of us are self-employed. We are all the presidents of our own personal services corporations. Now, this is an attitude of mind. The reality is that from the time you take your first job to the time you retire, you are self-employed. You work for yourself. The biggest mistake we can ever make is to ever think that we work for anyone else but ourselves. We work for ourselves. The person who signs our paycheck may change. Our job may change. Our occupation, our career may change, but we are always the same. We are the one constant. We are always self-employed. Many people think this is a cute idea. Well, that's a cute idea. I'm the president of my own company. It's a cute idea. It's got a lot of cute ideas up there today. The fact of the matter is that this is not optional. It's like breathing. We say, well, I don't know if I'll breathe or not. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. No. It's mandatory. Just because you did not know or it was not clarified to you that you are self-employed and the president of your own personal services corporation, just because you didn't know did not mean that it was not true. Now you know, now you can never avoid it. You are the president of your own company. You are the president of your own career. You're the president of your own life. You're the president of your own family, your own body, your own health, your own finances. You are totally responsible. The mark of the superior person is that they are totally responsible. They say, I am responsible. If it's to be, it's up to me. If there's anything in my life I don't like, It's up to me to change it. I am responsible. You are responsible. We are responsible. No one will ever do it for us. There are other cultures, by the way, where this whole concept of self-responsibility is overwhelming because they've been brought up by the state to believe that they are parts of a collectivist state and they don't own themselves. They belong to the state. What they earn is owned by the state. The state may allow you to keep a little, but the idea that you are responsible is just a remarkable thought. I go and say this in Finland or in Germany or in Austria or Poland or Slovenia, as I was last month, and people go, hey, sure, who eats for you? Do you eat? Who eats for you? Well, I eat. Who breathes for you? I breathe. Who sleeps for you? I do. Who's in charge of your life? What suddenly dawns on them? It's the most liberating and exhilarating thought of all, is to think that you're the president of your own life. In fact, you determine your own paycheck. Ultimately, by what you do or don't do, you determine the amount that you earn. If you're not happy with the amount that you're earning, now turn to the next page. And on the next page where it says action commitment, I want you to write at least one specific thing that you are going to do differently as a result of what we've just talked about. This is very important that you write this down. Just write one thing you're going to do differently. I am going to take total responsibility for my life. I'm going to position myself as a consultant in my accounts and in everything I do. I am going to confront my fears. Whatever it happens to be, just make a specific decision. And what will jump into your mind is the one thing that is probably the most helpful to you at this moment. Has everybody written down something? Now, this is very important. I designed this workbook, by the way, so that if you fill in the blanks as we go, you'll have a complete manual for success for the next few years.
This is the end of this disc. The program continues on the next CD.